Welcome to Community Conversations with State Attorney Bain, your talk show for insights on the criminal justice system, community issues, and public safety in Orange and Osceola counties. Join State Attorney Andrew Bain as he dives into the issues that matter most to you, keeping it real every step of the way.
All right. Welcome everyone to our last show of October. All month I've been talking about domestic violence awareness. We are in the final throes of that. Sorry for the usual casual bow tie. If you're looking for that, I am we'll be on an outside event a little later this afternoon. So Florida is hot still, even though it is fall, and I'm a big man and I sweat a lot. And so we are on to our next conversation here, Community Connections. And I always want to talk about, you know, what's going on with office, kind of highlights of like the week before. And the biggest conversation I've been having all weekend, starting with the end of our Sarah Boone trial. So if you were following it on Court TV and all the other various news outlets, both locally and domestic and nationwide, it was a very interesting case. People have been asking me what type of suitcase was it that he was zipped up in. If you don't know, sure the facts of the case, Sarah Boone zipped her boyfriend up in a suitcase and suffocated him to death. And basically, as he was crying out for help, she decided that she was going to go take a nap instead of helping him out of the suitcase. And then which posed all type of different questions to me via text and social media. The type of suitcase, how big was the suitcase, was the carry-on, how big was he? He was a very tiny man, around 100 pounds, but still, it was a crazy case, crazy trial, and I'm glad that we became victorious as justice was served, and her sentencing will be in December of this year. And just want to follow back up. We had a great time. As far as domestic violence awareness last week, there's multiple events. There was an event last night at UCF, another candlelight visual for domestic violence. We had our own event at the office called Voices of Hope. It was a very powerful event. We had to hear from different survivors and speakers. The Stand Up Survivor is a organization here, and their founder, Lisa, gave her story about escaping domestic violence. She will tell you that she left multiple times, nearly a dozen times before she left, it finally ended. It started off as small escalations. If you come back a few episodes ago at the beginning of this month, you'll hear her story. It came as fall escalations and then, you know, led to physical assaults after she became pregnant. Assaults continued after she became pregnant again. Her second child, and then she just decided that she was going to save her kids and save her life and left. And you also heard a story, if you were tuning in to our newsletter, and we were at the event last week, from one of our ASAs, Ralph. He was telling a story about his sister and how she was a victim of a domestic violence homicide, suicide. So, and this is a quote that you could take from his story. I'm not going to get a full story because it's very detailed, very graphic. But that the boyfriend that had broken up with his sister, brought flowers and candy when he went to go see her, and instead gave her bullets when she didn't give him what he wanted, which was another back that shot at their relationship. He shot her multiple times as he reloaded his gun. And shot her some more, and then ended up taking his own life in the same car as her. So it's a real problem. And it's a real problem in our community. There's a real problem with making people aware of the resources they have, the choices they have. You are not confined to stay in silence and waste away and die slowly, or die from somebody that's going to kill you because of violence. We need to make sure that we are doing everything we can from my office standpoint, from the community standpoint, to let these no victims, any survivors know that they have a place to go, that people that are willing to listen to them, hear them, work on their cases, actively pursue justice, and get them out of those situations, and get their abuser, what they need. And so you know, there's a likely chance. Like, so, you know, we talked about adverse childhood experiences on the show a few months back. We had a big episode about it. But one of those adverse childhood experiences, if you grew up in a house with domestic violence, and we have way too many hot homes or households in our community that our children are growing up in domestic violence, because they're likely to become an abuser or become a victim of domestic violence if that's occurring. And we need to take a stand in making sure that doesn't happen. But this show, this particular show we're here to talk about today, is about stopping hate. So we became the recipient of the James Byrd Jr. Grant, and we received about $1 million out of $30 million that was given out by the federal government. And in that grant that was written, we wanted to attack and address hate, address hate crimes, address hate crime incidents, address the types of things that go on in our community when it comes to racial, when it comes to anti-Semitism, where it comes to all those different types of things. And we lived in a very interesting time in 2020. We lived in a, a very divided and you know, angry. And we had to start addressing some of these things that we didn't want to talk about. We didn't want to address. Then we launched forward into last year on October 7th. We had another time. We had to look each other in the face and address some of these issues when it was coming on. So we had to deal with the issues, whether it was George Floyd, whether it was, you know, Flannel Castile, Breonna Taylor, you know, whether it was the anti-Semitism that was brought about like last year, and the anti-Palestinian anger that came about last year. A lot of those things we had to address as a community. So we had to deal with the hate crime incidences, like what we call them. We'll tell you the difference. We'll go through that in a minute. And then we make sure that we don't have any hate crimes, that we don't have crimes committed because of somebody's color, because of somebody's race, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, gender, that we're not doing that. And so I'm partnering with, you know, my favorite light-skinned brother, Dr. Levitt at the Stonewall Institute, and he's going to help us build that program out, both an education piece, and then I want to do what I do, which is on the prosecution side and building out a prosecution piece. And we're going to educate the public, we're going to educate law enforcement, we're going to educate our community, and we're going to try to then educate my lawyer. I'm going to try to educate my prosecutors so they can educate juries and judges, and we're going to educate them so we can get those prosecutions at a higher clip. It's a very unreported crime. Hate crimes are. You'll find that most people don't know that the reason why this is happening is because somebody has a prejudice towards them, that they're targeting them because of any of those things I listed before. So we want to make sure that we are addressing those issues and we're going to handle them in an appropriate way. So, but we're also going to bring on one of my good friends, and super senior pastor, retired, he claims, but he's back at it, and Dr. Joel Hunter, and he's going to talk to us about the pledge, which Dr. Levitt also worked on, that came about a little bit after October 7th, and we're going to be talking, addressing about all the things that they're doing in that program, and what we need to also be doing in the community. So let's get right into it, and let's have a great time. All right. Hello, gentlemen. How's everybody doing?
Good. I'm just wondering whether you just committed a hate crime by referring to me as light skinned. And then the white man, you didn't say nothing about him. So I'm going to have a talk with you as my former student, Bane.
Hey, we're here. As I told you, we were talking this morning, and I was like, hey, the show is different. There's no media. I'm the media in the show, so I can run how the show however I want to.
Dr. Hunter, this is my former student calling me light skin on a show about hate crimes. I haven't cast my vote yet. Where's my ballot? Hold on. You see my ballot is right here. I haven't cast my ballot yet, so you see what I mean? I might have to amend something. Good to
well,
be
welcome,
with you.
Welcome.
Good to be with you, babe. Good to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, y'all, gentlemen. You know, this is something that when I first came into office last year, Dr. Levitt and I were talking about what are the things that we want to do. And so we started off talking about our de-escalation stuff. We want to talk about, you know, getting kids home safely, getting our citizens home safely when it comes to law enforcement interactions. And we also then escalated to like, well, you know, what are we doing about, you know, the George Floyds and all those kind of things like that, and the hate that was going on. And then, you know, the October 7th happens, and then, you know, we're trying to figure it out. And so this became a product of, you know, trying to create this task force and making sure that we're going to do what the community needs, which I talk about all the time, is that my job is to give the community what they say they need. And we look out in our community and we still see a lot of hate. So I'm prosecuting a gentleman for tagging swastikas during the hurricane, in downtown. So, you know, there's work to be done here, Dr. Hunter. So let's talk to a little bit about the pledge, you know, how you, Dr. Levitt, how that kind of came about. Tell the people a little bit about yourself, even by people that don't know who you are. Just kind of give us a little, you know, greetings from you.
Okay. I'm just a longtime pastor, period. I've been a pastor for 55 years, but a pastor in Central Florida for about 40 years. I was a senior pastor of Northland Church for 32 years. And then I went, worked with the homeless quite a bit, and am now the pastor of community benefit at Action Church, Young Evangelical Church. My background is I came out of the civil rights movement, and that's how I went into the ministry. As a matter of fact, it was fun. A few months ago, I was in Birmingham for my granddaughter's graduation from Samford, and I rolled past the same bus stop that I had rolled into in 1968 as a part of the civil rights movement. It was really a deja vu, So anyhow, I've always had this heart for justice and including those that were being left out. When October 7th, fast forward to October 7th, Dr. Levitt and I have worked on different things, responses to bias and prejudice and discrimination in our community here. When October 7th happened, I was approached by a Jewish philanthropist, Allen Ginsberg, who said, I hear a lot of individual organizations, or not a lot, but a few individual organizations come out with statements about anti-Semitism. He said, but what we need is a regional response, a Central Florida response. Will you help me organize that? And I said, absolutely. And so we got a group of community leaders, first 50 and then 2 weeks later 100, into a room, and we said, if we were to make a statement from our community about protecting vulnerable groups that are facing persecution or hate or other forms of harassment and threats, what would that statement have to look like? And so we cobbled together a statement that is literally from the community. We didn't write out a statement and give it to people to sign. This literally is from the community leaders from every sector. We had presidents of universities, presidents of healthcare. We had the press. We had, of course, students from every campus. We had business, we had arts and entertainment, every sector of our culture, especially with law enforcement and the legal profession. But so every sector was in that room, faith leaders. And basically we came up with this statement that does two distinct things. First of all, it gives people the opportunity to personally pledge that they will respect all people, treat all people with kindness and respect, especially those with whom they disagree. Now, this, it's really important in these times to note that. They themselves will refrain from inflammatory words and actions. They will report incidences of hate and violence, and they will educate themselves about discrimination and the initial categories we came up with that we specifically wanted to address, of course, are racism, the perennial, but the LGBTQ community, and then, of course, the rise in anti-Semitism after October 7th. The increase of incidents was almost 380%. And correspondingly, the anti-Islamophobia, there were incidents of hate that were over 200% increase. So bottom line, we want to do a couple of things. First of all, we want to do prevention. That comes with what you're doing, Attorney Bain, with this new program of education so that people can know what they're talking about and know how to respond. And then we want to do a realm of community protection. That is, we now have almost 3,000 people on a network that if there is an incident that happens in Central Florida, there will be a community response, not just a law enforcement response, not just a legal response, but every person in that network that is signed onto the pledge will be notified with a helpful way to respond. Not counter demonstrate, that just ratchets up the anger, but the helpful way to stand with that group that is being persecuted or threatened or harassed. So bottom line, it's a positive community response that literally wants to change the culture of our community so that we have a culture of respect and we have a culture of standing with any of our neighbors, especially any groups. We don't do a lot with individuals, but we do a lot with groups. Any groups that are currently ongoing, incurring incidents of hate or prejudice.
Okay. So tell people how they can sign the pledge.
Okay. The simple way is one of two ways. You can go to centralfloridapledge.com and sign on, and you will see all of the resources. The simplest way, though, is download an app, go to the App Store, and go to Pledge Central, and that will give you all of the resources for training. And hopefully, as you develop your program, Mr. Bain, we can load those resources onto that app as well, so that everybody has automatic access to those training resources that they can share. And so the important thing, though, is when you sign on to the pledge, you become a part of, you know, in our history, it was the Minutemen. You know, you just go, you're going about your normal life, but when attack comes, you're ready to go into action to defend your community. And so so that's how to do it. Go to centralfloridapledge.com or download the app Pledge Central.
Dr. Levitt, what are you?
Well, so let me back up. So Joel missed a couple points about him that I think is important to know. Coming from Shelby, Ohio, a native, it's been a long time, Joel, but that, those are your roots. And I think in this area and beyond, one of the pastors and leaders who has been willing to be challenged, to try and look at things new, to acknowledge fault, particularly during the George Floyd era and things that could have been done within Central Florida by more inclusive action with Black pastors, more engagement in the Black community in particular. And certainly, has been a leader at demonstrating the kind of compassion and the willingness to speak out against things like Christian nationalism and those things that are harmful. But he also, I think it's really important to know, was one of Barack Obama's spiritual advisors. And for the African-American community, that I think is an important note to make, because when you are providing spiritual advice to one of the most powerful people in the world, who is grounded in faith, then there's a certain level of influence there that I think is noteworthy. So I think Joel is one of those good people. And what I like about him is just the honesty, to hear, to be challenged. I think both of you know I have no problem challenging something when I think the facts and the truth stand behind it, and pushing the envelope a bit to advance our democracy in the way. So I'm glad you're here, Joel, and I'm glad that Bain has you on. You know, Bain it's kind of full circle in some ways, because when you see a former student move in a certain direction and take critique, but also take recommendations. We talked about this before he even had taken the office, about the potential of creating a hate crimes mechanism. He's been, you know, lockstep in trying to move in that direction. In a very short period of time has made significant, I think, progress. And this has resulted in this grant that now we have to help stimulate and operationalize some of the things that are in the pledge. The full circle part is that when I started the Stonewall Institute after George Floyd was murdered, the Ginsburg Foundation was one of the first to give me seed money. Mm-hmm. So all of these things come together for the good, right? And so we're able to kind of cross-pollinate here. And so I think all of this pledge is only as good as the operationalization of it, and you can only do so much. So this partnership, the State Attorney Office, will allow us to move now in a direction. And I love the idea of creating within the pledge a community of people who will not be silent when there are attacks against certain groups. African Americans, by a supermajority, are the group most affected by hate crimes in the United States. Mm-hmm. As a racial group and as a religious group. And I always debate with the rabbis about the Jewish community being just a religious group, but is also a racial and cultural group. I'm a part of that group. Mm-hmm. And I think the numbers would increase if there was a different way to categorize it. But Jews are the group most impacted by religious-based hate crime. Yeah. And so we recognize these things and said that something needed to be done about them in a way that brings people together to solve problems, whether it's education, whether it's outreach, whether it's prosecution, whether it's reconciliation, and that law enforcement has to do a better job of not just reporting these crimes to the FBI, but knowing how to take in the crimes when people are making a complaint, because there are a lot of incidents that are not hate crimes, but that go down as hate incidents. And I know State Attorney Bain, when we talked about it, that we want to begin to also record hate incidents, because right. It's the incidents that will lead to a crime if unaddressed. And I think there's a role within the pledge context to also not just look at hate crimes. I think you're right, as not to just focus on the legal definition, because it's really too high of a standard, right. But to look at hate incidents and to push back the pledge. Well,
and one of the things you're talking about, Dr. Leavitt, and after this, I want to hear more about Attorney Bain's plans on rolling this thing out. But the increase in reports of incidents is going to help our community to face the fact that there is a real need, especially right now, to, again, one of the things I like about you, Dr. Leavitt, is you're a good rebuker, you know, I mean, and in a helpful way, because everybody knows that I mean, they think in their best selves that discrimination is wrong, but they seem to think there's not much of it around if it's not brought to their attention. And the increase of these reports will help them face the fact that not only do they exist, but they need to do something about it. And starting with, gosh, part of this probably my fault. You know, I probably am complicit in this. One of the things, let me tell you a story. At Barack Obama's, and we really had a great relationship for 8 years. But at his inauguration, in the 1960s, when Muhammad Ali first became a Muslim, he was outrageous. He was just that was part of who he was.
And, bombastic, not outrageous.
Bombastic, yes. Mm-hmm. And but he came to Ohio University where I was doing my undergraduate work in history and government. And he gave this just, you know, very bombastic talk about Christianity. And I, of course, I was a Christian at the evangelical Christian. And he was kind of, before he knew that Muslims believed in the virgin birth, he was kind of making fun of the virgin birth. And I was so mad at him. And I just, you know, was saying bad stuff. And well, 50 years later, I'm looking for my place on the dais. I'm about eight rows behind President Obama before he takes the oath. And I'm looking for my seat, and there's my seat, says Dr. Hunter on it. And I'm sitting beside Muhammad Ali. and God is just saying, okay, you got some apologizing to do here. Mm-hmm. And so I had this conversation with Muhammad Ali. He wasn't talking much because of the speech problem he had with the palsy, but he could nod. And it was a kind of a way of repentance for what I had done in the past. God saw that I could repent and help him up and tell him that one of the reasons that we both were sitting there is the work that he had done and so on and so forth. I want that same kind of repentance for our community, that we face some things that we've been complicit in. And this time is just ripe. And as the culture gets more and more polarized and we get more and more malicious in our rhetoric, we're going to have more and more of these incidents. So I couldn't be more excited about this grant that you're getting, State Attorney Bain. Maybe you could tell us how do you build around that? What are you going to do with that?
I think we're going to do I want to do my lawyer talk first. So you hear, if you're listening to the show, you've heard us talk about hate crime incidences and we talked about hate crimes. Those are two distinct things. They're related but distinct in what the law says. And so a hate crime incident could be somebody, you know, running up to an African American, you know, using the N word or any other derogatory language, puppet and so forth. And then it could be, you know, doing some other things, you know, the swastikas and other hate symbols that have come up. And so that could be an incident that needs to be reported because we need to keep track of those. But when you accompany that with a crime, we accompany that with a criminal mischief or a theft or a battery, a robbery or some sort, some type of assault, then that with the you add those two together, the hate crime incident and what would be a traditional crime, that's how you get a hate crime. And so in the Florida legislature gives us a hate crime enhancement statute that will enhance those types of crimes 1 degree above what the regular crime would be charged. So for instance, so a robbery is a second degree felony. It's usually punishable up to 15 years in the Department of Corrections. But if it's a robbery consistent with prejudice or with a hate crime enhancement, it'll become a first degree felony and it'll be punishable to 30 years in the Department of Corrections. And so that's how our structure works inside the state of Florida. The federal government has a similar statute. Their statute is a little bit more expansive than ours. And so If we can get what they call diversity of jurisdiction, which means that we can connect that crime to some kind of commerce or, you know, with between states or something like that, we can then that charge can be handled by Roger Hamburg. And he has his own type of hate crime initiative that had been handled down by the U.S. Attorney General, because he has a United Against Hate initiative. The U.S. Attorney General, that was one of his priorities that he when he came into office. And so we're just picking back up on that on a local level. And what I see this going, and what Dr. Levin and I have been talking about for some months, is really getting into the community and educating them on those two differences, and educating them on different resources, educating them on how to report those crimes, and kind of like the Central Florida Pledge website. We want to have a centralized place where they can report a hate crime or hate crime incident. And, we have to train law enforcement because, they may just think it's a regular robbery. Like, okay, somebody broke into your, especially if you're a business owner, we had a rise in, Asian hate and those kinds of things like that, or African-American racial hate, even after George Floyd and COVID and things like that. They may not just be breaking into your business because they think you have money. They may break into your business because they're targeting you because you're Asian or African-American or Jewish or Muslim. That's the reason why they may be targeting your business. And if we don't teach the law enforcement officers how to investigate those instances just by asking a few more questions or taking a few extra steps, it's going to be an underreported hate crime that occurred. And so we want to make sure that we're addressing the education training portion of it first. There's going to be a mediation portion. We want to see how Dr. Levitt is as a mediator, and mediating some of those some instances that happen between two groups that you talked about. So we've had, like, UCF's been an hot spot for that, University of Central Florida. We've been monitoring that from where I sit. The Central Florida UCF police chief has also been monitoring what's been going on, and we've had a couple close calls there with the two groups on campus. And we need to be able to mediate those discussions between those two groups. Both are hurting, and we have to recognize that both those groups are hurting, and that both of them need a way to mediate those emotions and to get through to a working relationship, because there's nothing that's going to be set, that's going to be solved stateside if we can't be united in how we go address those issues. And so that's a second option of it. And obviously, third option, like we talked about, is turning those hate crime instances that turn to crimes into prosecutions and successful prosecutions by being able to, train my assistant state attorneys and the juries and the judges on how and why this is different and what makes this different. And even though the standards is pretty high, like Dr. Levitt talked about in the state of Florida, to get a conviction for that, we want to still keep pressing that issue to make sure that we are giving it our best opportunity to be successful in those prosecutions.
Prevention. I mean, Joel, one of the keys to all of this, even the pledge, is prevention. Yeah. And so, two kind of examples that kind of bleed out a little bit more about what he has said. So the UCF is a great example. So one is being proactive. When we see the tides turning in a certain way in the national or international discourse that affect our populations, to begin a conversation then. I personally, this is just me, I'm not speaking for the state attorney's office or you, but for me and the Stono Institute, our position is that UCF did not respond well. They did not facilitate the kind of open a town hall conversation around these sensitive issues for these students. Because what happens is that there are pent up hostilities and we're dealing with young people who don't know how to voice their grievance. And so it's up to institutions to create the platform for the conversation as a tool of conflict prevention and resolution. That was not done. It wasn't done effectively. Many universities struggle with this. We've seen it at UCLA. And so when they fail to do that, it actually rises civil society tension beyond the campus to a higher level because it's being reported in the news in a certain context. So this is where I think the pledge and Stono and the pledge can team up. about getting in on the ground level on some of these things that we see coming, and then beginning to start a discourse and some preparation even with university officials about things that they might be able to do to curb a conflict. So when Bain and I discussed it, prevention was a big part of it. An example, though, of a hate crime, I love using this example. So and I'll use Bain's opener, right? Because this is going to hit right on the gray line. So Bain and I are driving our cars, and he cuts me off, and I pull up next to him and say, "You cut me off. You're a bad person," with the expletives that I use so well. And he doesn't like it. He's a big guy. I'm a big guy. We're looking at each other. And he gets out of his car, and I get out of my car. And so now we're wrestling. So now we have a mutual combat, maybe assault, maybe disrupting in some way. And there's some violation that's been created. But now he's using light skin expletives to demean me in the context of our wrestle, right? The question then is that a hate crime? Well, it could very well be. It would be hard to prove that point in the sociology and psychology of society, because they would say it's two black people. But let's say I'm the Jew that I am. I'm a Jew, and you're calling me a name, or you're using my skin color, or you're using one of the protected categories, whatever they are. Mm-hmm. Then that crime can be enhanced to that higher level. And we notice that most hate crimes are actually committed on the property of the victim, on the physical property of the victim. So a lot of these things start out one way and then they evolve into something else. And this is one of the reasons why law enforcement has not been able to really capture it. If you're a victim of sex crimes, you have specifically trained officers that are trained to investigate sex crimes, and they know what questions to ask and they know what kits to bring. We don't do that when it comes to hate crimes. We don't even do it when it comes to biased policing, quite frankly, right? Which is another end of the same, spectrum. So these things are not reported in the way that they could be reported with additional training. And the biggest issue is then when you look at, for example, the Jewish community, it usually comes in monikers and stereotypes like other groups. How do you know then it's a hate crime? Well, if you're from, I don't want to name anyone's particular city, but you're not familiar with the Jewish population, and someone is calling you, those money hoarding Jews, for example. Well, that has a very specific lineage to it with the Jewish population that it may not have with others. And if you're not in tune and educated about what that means, you may not even think about it in the hate crime context. But that is a part of the trope, the racialized cultural religious trope, the moniker put on Jews. So having the training to be able to spot these things is vitally important. So I think in going forward, we're going to have more struggle with incidents than we will with crimes. But if in doing that, we'll be able to then prevent the crimes from occurring and creating the dialogue and the understanding around it. So
just from my standpoint, it's so important lately, and we've talked about this, Dr. Leavitt, there have been this, what I call an epidemic of Christian nationalism, which is basically white supremacy covered over with a thin veneer of religious terminology, but the bottom line is that if most, and this is from my tribe, if most Christian people can be educated and become alert as to what the terminology is being used. What are the dog whistles for racism and anti-Semitism and other kinds of terminology that are trigger words, and we can educate the general population. When you hear this kind of phrase or when you hear this kind of accusation, mm-hmm. that there's something deeper going on there. And it really does fit into categories. It's not just an individual that is making a judgment. That fits into a category then. And that will be much more helpful when it comes to responding to group prejudice. And so that's, I look forward to an educated population.
No, yeah. I mean, Ben, you can talk on that, but I think that was part of when we discussed it, that education was a critical part of it. And we're all part of that tribe. He's a pastor's son. And I would say a struggling Christian, not struggling in the faith, just struggling to be a good guy sometimes. And you know that I'm a minister. So we're all working every day and fighting our own impulses. And so just to go to your comment, Joe, I think part of it is it's finding what your impulses are, because all of us have bias. Now, bias is not prejudice and bigotry and racism, but we have biases, but it's those impulses when triggered that can lead to those other things. And so I think him and I talked, I'll let him expand on it, but I just want to say this, that question is critical because per capita, Florida has the largest number of white supremacist groups in the country. Mm-hmm. And the Southern Poverty Law Center says that we have at least 114. So this is a real issue. This is not a small issue in the state of Florida. But if you go to any police agency and ask them how many bias reports do you have or hate crimes do you report, the number is very small in comparison to the number of groups and people who might be like-minded or have a similar stream of consciousness. But Bane, I'll let you expand on that.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, my biggest statement always is, you know, education is crime prevention. So, you know, I believe wholeheartedly, if you have a well-educated society, it's hard to oppress them. You know, it's just, you know, there's a few times in history that may have come about, but usually that's because that particular group didn't have a political stake. But in the United States right now, you know, we have political stakes all over and from all different types of groups. So we have to work on that. But, you know, the education piece is critical. It's critical to pretty much everything that I do on the prevention side of law on prosecution and criminal justice. It's just, you know, it's no different than from literacy to, you know, soft skill training that I do for people trying to find jobs, all those kind of things like that, all about, if I can educate you and I can get you in the right position, I shouldn't have to deal with you on a criminal justice side. In this particular case, this is about building a harmonious community. This is, not, I mean, and I don't want people to think about, like, we're talking about utilitarianism. Like, that's not what we're talking about. Like, we're not going to, this is not going to be a utopian type world. I mean, I think all of us, like I said, everybody here is a believer and an elder. You know, the Bible's pretty straight clear about that. That's not what's going to happen. But I think it brings us closer to an idea that we are going to live in a society that is, you know, tolerant of people of differences, you know, and then, I mean, not just tolerant, but we turn that tolerance into an actual, you know, abiding with that person. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, one of the first, like I tell you, I laugh because, like, you know, because we're going to get real biblical for a second. You know, this is Aaron's wife and Moses, you know, and his wife. You know, Aaron's wife and his Moses, they were complaining about, you know, his wife was a Bedouin woman. And, like, you know, those are, and that was, and God showed up. You know, God showed up at that moment in a cloud of smoke. It was like, hey, this is something not just you know, a thing, you know, saying this is something fundamental to what I believe.
Yeah.
And so we had to go about addressing it in a way that creates that abiding nature amongst each other, and it creates a abiding nature amongst what's going on. And unfortunately, right now, we live in a world that if you're different, two things are happening. Somebody is, you know, trying to tell you that, well, you can't tell me that I'm different, and, you know, I want to hate you because I'm different. Or, you know, that it's the other way around. You're different, and since you don't agree that I'm different, you must hate me. Those are the things that are going on, and that doesn't make, and that, for me, that makes not a lot of sense. you know, you can be a different faith, you know, Islam, Jewish, you know, I'm married to a Hindu woman, for instance. You know, it's going to be Diwali on Thursday, and at the same time as Halloween. So, like, there's all types of things like that, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to treat her any different, love her any different, you know, give, like, show all of the fruits of the spirit to her on a daily basis. That doesn't make that, that doesn't change those things, but we have to change the narrative of our community to move towards that direction, and educating each other, the mediation portions of it, you know, learning about these different places of culture. Why do they believe what they believe? Where are they from? You know, what and why, how can we incorporate that into what we, into the fabric of our community? And so, and that's not happening around the nation. So, and I was talking, I was at a conference with the U.S. attorney from Ohio, and another couple of U.S. attorneys from Louisiana. And, you know, they were having issues with the Haitian population being targeted for robberies. Hmm. And it's because, like, they were like, they're working, you know, kind of these cash jobs, these migrant type jobs. And then because they didn't have their citizenship, but they were being targeted because they're, you know, African-American and they're Haitian. And that was, they're African, they're Haitian, from Haitian descent, and they are being targeted because of that. And so this is not something that's like, that doesn't happen. Like, I mean, I think people have this misunderstanding that, like, you know, these crimes don't occur. They occur, I would say, pretty much regularly, every day.
Yeah.
But if we don't take the steps and the time to get to the root cause of those things and address them, just going to be a slow decay from the under bottom of our society. And but we need to address those issues going forward. So
I think we got a couple of things going for us that you know, I travel quite a bit, and I've been in a lot of other parts of the country, and Central Florida really does have some positive factors that some other communities may not. One is, for good or for better or for worse, Disney has really changed. There's a lot of not so good consequences of an entertainment economy. But one of the good results is people want kind of the wholesome family vision, and they have a special place in their heart for kids, you know. So as we talk about these very difficult issues, it's not for people like me, you know, it's for what kind of community do I want my grandkids to grow up in? What kind of world do I want for them? And so I think that is a really motivating factor. The other thing is, just like we're talking right now, there's a lot of leaders in this community who really appreciate one another, who really respect one another, and who want to work together. And so we've got, and that's getting better and better. It used to be that, you know, we were polite when we waved on our way by each other. But now it's very evident that we have it within our grasp to create these organizations that are not organizations so much, they're networks of a lot of different efforts and populations that have to work together, because none of us can solve this by ourselves. And so we're faced with the fact that if we want to change the culture, we got to do this together. And I think a lot of people are realizing that.
Part of it, Joe, is I also think that we have to not underestimate the power of social media. Whether it's a bad police stop that occurs in one state, it's as if it occurred here to the people watching it. Mm-hmm. It's the same with crimes. And we've seen now with October 7th that reverberates something that is thousands of miles away in a different region of the world entirely, reverberates right here locally.
Yeah.
And we have to become more educated about the impacts of global events and national events on our local population.
Yeah.
Because the people see themselves as extensions of certain communities, and digital technology allows us to actually be that way. You can get a post from Gaza right now, and if you're a Palestinian, that is a spirit injury to you. You're feeling that. If you're a Jew in Tel Aviv and a drone explodes or missiles are being fired from Iran, you feel that as a Jew everywhere in the world. And so learning how to, at a psychological level, draw the empathy for people who can suffer, who are not immediately under fire, but have the spirit injury, is important, because these things are the things that activate the impulses that can go one direction or another.
Absolutely. I love it that one of the first reactions a lot of people have when they see conflict is to pull out their cell phones. Because I literally remember in the 60s, the absolute change in this country when they saw those hoses turned on the black demonstrators and the dogs going after the black demonstrators. There was an absolutely switch flipped moment for our nation when the broadcast media showed those films. Well, we have that in microcosm with everybody with a cell phone right now. So if that can be a part of the reporting, that will not only create information, it will create empathy. Certainly,
but it also creates the demand that the old way of responding to these major crises is not to wait. We have to have the capacity, just like a hurricane, to respond immediately. We have to do the preparation for it, and then we have to respond, because, you know, if you're on a college campus and something's happening and it's right there in your hand, what do you have as a resource that is available to you that will help you as a young person that doesn't have the maturity know how to manage your feelings and emotions and response, right? Yeah. You went back to the 60s. I can tell you that in a book I'm writing, one of the interesting things is hearing King discuss Zionism and discuss the response after Patrice Lumumba of the Congo was murdered, mm-hmm. and how that reverberated in college campuses, particularly at HBCUs around the country. Mm-hmm. So the point is that now we're at a different level in terms of technology. The difference is there was time to study and think about these things. Now we have kids who don't even know how to place them in the proper context, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. so thinking about this as part of the education and outreach and dialogue part is critical, because I can tell you the issue that occurred at UCF, I think, was avoidable with the right kind of response initially. It was avoidable. It's when people feel hopeless, mm-hmm. And that nobody cares, and there is a lack of empathy, that's when you tend to see the responses, mm-hmm. right? And particularly when you're in a minority within a minority, mm-hmm. right? You can really feel the effects of that. When you're a Jew and there's only 16 million in the world, mm-hmm. There's a right to feel some paranoia there when you're seeing a 300% spike in anti-Semitic crimes. When you're a Muslim student, you're a Palestinian student, which is a small population of people, and you're on UCF's campus, and you're seeing the resources support the Jewish community that might be coming from private sources, but certainly there's a larger network, you feel like you're in the shadows of a response. So knowing how to mediate that and create the kind of dialogue is vital, and I think we have a big role to play in shaping that.
You agree.
Yeah, so that's where we're winding down here again towards the end of the show. I'm just going to tell you, that's how everybody felt, watching George Floyd. That was our, I think our generation's Emmett Till at that moment. Mm. And then so that's kind of how, I felt. That's what I immediately thought about when it was happening. And then, I have two big pet peeve cases. The other one is Breonna Taylor. The other one being Philando Castile. Truly, truly, truly avoidable situations. you know, when it came to training, when it came to response, when it came to everything, avoidable tragedies that our community has suffered. And, you know, we have to recognize that people are hurting because of that.
Freddie Gray.
You know, we got Auberry, you know, my Auberry, you know, out of Georgia, you know, all those kind of things, you know, and then so, yes, people feel like, well, must be happening here. And then, you know, then you have increased rhetoric from all sides of what's going on. And then instead of focusing on the people that are actually involved in the situation. And so that's where, you know, I'm really excited to have this continued conversation, this continued path forward to be able to build out this program in a way that's going to address a lot of those issues when it comes to policing, when it comes to response from institutions and communities as well, because I'm an opinion, maybe the minority opinion, we didn't get anything out of 2020.
And people won't even mention George Floyd's name anymore, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We didn't get anything out of it. My wife's from Minneapolis. That's where she grew up. We take family vacations there every single year. You go there, they built this monument, this memorial monument, and that's all they got out of it. Hmm. All the businesses left downtown. Downtown was a vibrant, beautiful place. All business left out of downtown, they moved to Edina. Mm-hmm. They moved out into the suburbs. And then so the people, so all they did was segregate the city even more than where it was.
Well, but Bane, that's there. I mean, Joe, when you look at here, there was this response.
Yep.
There was this push of DNI, which has been reversed in the past year. Everybody was putting a little bit of money into causes. We know as a racial justice organization that no one's even thinking about it. They don't care about it. They don't want to think about it. Then mm-hmm. D&I was under attack mm-hmm. and nobody said anything, right? This is why the pledge group is important, because there should be a pushback on the killing of D&I. There should be a pushback on killing Black history, right? Yeah. The pipeline to anti-Semitism is anti-Blackness. There was mm-hmm. anti-Blackness in America before there was anti-Semitism. And this is mm-hmm. why there was the Jewish and Black Union that has subsided. And when that's weak, right, the attacks against both communities flare up, and they're from the same groups and the same people and the same mindset. The one thing that we have that others don't have, and I go back to technology, is we literally, this is real, this is not made up. We have other nations now that are aware of the societal cleavages that we have in America. And they have covert campaigns of influence that are enormous. The Chinese, the Iranians, the Russians in particular, are using that to sow divide. They want us to kill ourselves from within, right? They want us to corrode internally so that there is not a nuclear war, right? That we can do ourselves in. And we are getting closer and closer to that. And that has, I think, great spiritual ramifications, right? I think when you were talking, Joe and Bane, we got to be reminded of Ephesians 6:12, right? That you know, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but principalities and powers and the dark forces of the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're at that place where we have to be
mindful. Sorry, Doc. We're at that place. We're about 30 seconds, like before we're done, about a minute, 30 seconds. So I know we got a lot. We're going to come back in part two of this. Mm-hmm. This is a long conversation that we're going to have. We'll definitely have another episode related to this, and we're going to make sure that we're going to do everything we can to address all the issues that we have in our community as it relates to hate. So thank you both for coming on. I appreciate you all, and I'll see you soon. All right, great. So we're down to our motivational minute, ladies and gentlemen. And so this morning, because I don't sleep, I was strolling, I catched a little bit of the pivot where former President Obama was talking. And he was talking about mentorship and talking about the young men that he mentors. And he was talking about, you belong at the table. And there's something that I share with my mentees and discussing with them, because if you put yourself at the table, you pull up to the table and know that you belong there, you'll realize that the people at other people at the table are just like you. And they may have a little bit more money or a little more influence, but they're just people, and you can succeed at the same level they are. And so with that, I want to thank you all and to motivate you to continue to fight and to elevate yourself every day.
You've been listening to Community Conversations with State Attorney Bain. Join us again next Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. for another episode. Looking for real talk on the criminal justice system and how we can work together to make our communities safer? Tune in to Community Conversations with State Attorney Bain every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. Join State Attorney Andrew Bain as he interviews community leaders and activists, diving into the topics that matter most in Orange and Osceola counties. Get insights, stay informed, and be part of the conversation.